We're now moving this morning to chapter 40 to 48. And we're in a whole new world to what we've been in from chapter 1 to 39 of the scroll. We've left Isaiah ben Amoz behind. This material is written, I suggest to you, by a school of prophet preachers. The auditory factor in it is quite palpable. My guess is that they were talking in the synagogues, which probably started in the exile when there's no temple, you see. So they're communicating verbally, and then, of course, it's written. So they're a prophetic school. They show their familiarity with the Isaiah tradition, and we'll notice that at times, as they do with other prophetic and Deuteronomic material. So they're not just reliant on Isaiah, they're aware of the other material from the prophets, and they're obviously conscious, when you read the literature, of the Deuteronomy, which I've done with you in other occasions. But their writing has its own distinct character, which has more in common with the temple singers responsible for the Psalms. When you read this part of Isaiah, you could be reading the Psalms, the music of it, the cadence of it, the way it's... So they probably were temple singers. There's no temple anymore. They're not producing Psalms anymore for the singing in the temple, and this is what they're turning their mind and art to. Now, that's not certain, what I'm telling you there. It's pretty recent scholarship I'm sharing with you. But I'm not sharing because it's recent. I'm sharing with you because I find it convincing. The post-exilic editors, leave this for a minute, the post-exilic editors, which we've been talking about the last 6 weeks, composed Isaiah 35, look back at it if you want to, and 36 to 39. 36 to 39 is the history that I just went over in about 2 minutes last week. They did that to link the Isaiah 2 to 34 with Isaiah 40 to 48. They brought the pre-Babylonian period to an end, and they introduced you to the Babylonian exile, which is where we are now. The key link is that the exilic writers of the Isaiah school, this is what they're key doing. Oh, thank you. The key link is that the exilic writers of the Isaiah school offer an assurance to the community, now this is quite extraordinary, that the sins of Jerusalem, which we've heard so much about in chapters 1 to 39, they're so prominent in the criticisms of Isaiah ben Amoz, that's the man, the prophet, from the 740 to 700 period, they've been pardoned and a new beginning is being offered. That's the key thing. They're saying, like, it's over. The punishment is over. You've been pardoned for those sins. God is offering a new beginning. Let's get ready to take it. What's the basis of their hope and the basis of their confidence that this has happened? Because, of course, the exile was seen as a punishment, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And there must have been something quite dramatic happening to alert them, because they're not looking in a crystal ball. They're looking at reality around them. Something must have happened, and I'm about to suggest to you what it is. Some of the content of Isaiah 40 to 48, this morning's topic, is better understood when we realise the pressure that the deported Judeans, from which we get our word Jew, were under in this multicultural environment with its powerful imperial deities. They've come from their little backwater up in the hills, and they've been dragged over to Babylon. And there's a lot of other people there too, of different cultures. They're open to a much bigger world than they ever had before. And they have these imperial deities of the Babylonian Empire. This helps account for the polemic against idols, which you'll find this morning throughout what we're doing, because idols are a big issue when you come into a pagan culture. And more importantly, for the stress throughout that Yahweh, the God of Israel is the Lord of creation and the Lord of history. Because the Babylonians, this mighty empire compared to them, and much more savvy and much more alert and much more scientifically beginnings, they're like they're much more a richer culture in every way except religion. They looked on their God as the Lord of history and the Lord of creation. And so our authors are saying they're wrong. Yahweh is. Now, two things that are absolutely essential as background to what I want to offer you this morning. I'm going to spend about half an hour on the background, but because I hope you know by now or agree with me, without knowing the situation, how on earth can you read what they're saying? First thing is the rise to power of Cyrus of Persia. So that's happening, and that's the background. That's why there's hope, because they're getting news from the east as Cyrus wins over this city and as the people... They didn't like Babylon. They didn't like the Babylonian Empire because of its methods. It's, for example, deportation of conquered peoples, etc. Cyrus was much more enlightened. And when he went, on the whole, he had two big battles, and that's about it. Otherwise, people just threw their doors open, welcomed him in because of the liberation that he brought with him. And that was happening. News of that is clearly filtering back to Babylon. So if there, that's good, and they're letting them go back home, and they're letting them renew, and they're letting them have their own religion, which of course the others didn't, can't you see how in exile this would arouse a hope? Like, I imagine it might be like, I don't know, the Allies, if you call them Allies, in the Second World War, coming into Poland or whatever it is, there's hope for the people in prison. The second thing that's obvious, I did in lecture one, look up your notes if you want to. The second thing you wouldn't be aware of probably, but it's very important. The New Year festival of the Babylonian god Marduk and the dramatic presentation at the New Year festival of the creation myth of the Babylonians, called the Enuma Elish. And that's going to, we're going to see, well, the more you look, I can't show you everything, of course, you see parallels between the language of this Isaiah school and the festivities carrying the statue and worshipping this Marduk. And second thing we're going to say is, this Enuma Elish creation myth has a big effect, I think, on the early chapters of Genesis, which I've come to see, I don't say with certainty, but having thought and been told and taught, it was in all the books, it was a unanimous opinion at one stage that belongs to the court of Solomon, you know, right back in the 10th century. Then scholarship gave that away because of archaeology and a whole lot of other things. Then they moved, and I moved with them. You might as well stay with the scholars. Who the heck do you think you are to know better than them? So I moved with the... And it looked much more likely that it was pre-exilic, and there'd be still a lot saying this, at the time of Josiah. That's the late 600s, just before the fall of Jerusalem. And that it probably belonged to that period, and I now think it's post-exilic. Exilic or post-exilic. And that actually the stories of Adam and Eve and the flood and all that mythology of the early part of the Bible are a Jewish reimagining of these myths that they possibly came into intimate contact with only in the exile. And they said, this is rubbish. There's a much more profound, and now they are more, the Jewish one are much more profound. So that's the background. And now I just read this for you as my introduction to the text. In the beginning, this is the Enuma Elish, quick story. It'd take longer if I gave it to you, but you can look it up on the internet and read the whole thing if you want to. In the beginning, there was nothing but the divine pair, Apsu and Tiamat. One is salt water and one's fresh water. So this is the chaos, the swirling waters, the darkness, you know, the Bible, in the beginning, and the darkness over the waters. Okay, so there's Tiamat and Apsu. from these primordial deities, so the myth, the Babylonian myth goes, several generations of gods were begotten. But the repose of Apsu was disturbed by these secondary gods. Apsu was used to a fairly quiet life, really. And then all these jabbering teenage gods were disturbing the house peace. Whom he, that's Apsu, therefore decided to destroy. I can't imagine a father wanting to destroy his children ever, but you might feel like it sometimes. So he determined to destroy them, and this was a proposal which Tiamat, the female goddess, didn't want. The wise god Ea, so here we've got another wise god coming in, discovered the plan and takes preemptive action by killing Apsu with the help of magic. So this world, you've got to get into this Babylonian world, plenty of, okay. The birth of Marduk followed, and his many attributes of this god Marduk, god of Babylon, are described, and of course they're pretty good. Meanwhile, Tiamat prepares for battle to avenge the death of her consort. She didn't agree with killing the kids, but she didn't want her husband magically killed. So she decides to avenge the death of Apsu, and she appoints Kingu as head of the divine assembly, leader of her army, and keeper of the tablets of destiny. Enjoying the story? Since the gods were afraid to take on Tiamat, Marduk, also known as Bel, and you'll find that word used in the book of Daniel, agrees to do so. He's going to take on Tiamat, with the condition that if he wins, he's appointed the supreme god in the divine assembly. Now that's ambition. The gods accepted with the acclamation, Marduk is king. This is all celebrated, eh, in the New Year festival, and it's heard by the Jews. Our text will be saying, Yahweh is king. They equip him with a scepter, a royal robe, throne, and magical weapons. And in the contest that follows, Tiamat is defeated and killed. And out of her body are created the sky, the stars, constellations, sun and moon, earth, and the waters surrounding the earth. All that stuff that's all through the early mythology of Genesis. The human being was a lowly little creature called Lulu, is created by the god Ea, this is your origin, so don't be giggling, out of the blood of the slaughtered Kingu. No wonder we've got this blood lustiness mixed with slime. Well, I'd rather the biblical story, really. There's plenty of slime there too, but there's the breath breathing in the spirit. To humanity is assigned the task of relieving the secondary gods of the duty of serving the high gods. The secondary gods, which are the most of the ones we're talking about, have been working for the bosses all the time, and they say, well, we're not going to do this anymore. Get these blooming human beings to serve the gods. In gratitude, the gods erect an Es-Sagila sanctuary for Marduk, Enlil, and Ea. They are the three famous, okay. A banquet follows, destinies are fixed, the poem ends with a recital of a litany of the 50 names of Marduk and the praise of his incomparable greatness. None among the gods can equal him. Our text will be saying, there is no one but Yahweh. Like they'll be, okay. Once the creation myth is presented, the statues of Marduk and his son Nebuchadnezzar, remember? It's in the front of Nabonidus. There's a few of the kings of Babylon have this name on the front, this divine name. They were led in procession to the Akitu house outside the city. And we'll see this morning Isaiah 46:1-2 parodies the procession, makes fun of it. They are all processing, they're processing out of the city and they're not, you know, into oblivion. It won't be long before the Babylonians will be packing up their gods in an effort to save them and processing out of the city, just as the gods of other cities, because of Cyrus, have had to move their gods out and escape. And they're going to process, all right, but not to this temple place, but into exile. Isaiah 51, 9 to 10, we'll do next week, portrays Yahweh, not Marduk, as slaying the beast of chaos, Tiamat, Tehu, Tohu, Wabohu, Hebrew. Yahweh is presented as the cosmic creator throughout, and against the Babylonian story of many gods, it is declared, quoting 43:10, we'll do it in a minute, before me no god was formed. Before Marduk, there were plenty of gods before, but before me none were formed. There will be none after me. This monotheism, a bit tricky, because the monotheism of the time here was, and it's still a bit that way, monotheism meant there's only one God and he's our God. They didn't get their brain to join the dots and think if there's only one God, it must be their God too, you know? So it wasn't. It was monotheism as a pretty nationally narrow way. Yahweh had no need of a counsellor such as Ea, whereas Marduk did. Yahweh, we're told in chapter 40 and 41, we'll look at it today, didn't need that. Do you see what I'm trying to do with you? I'm trying to help you read the text as it was read and enjoyed and dramatized at the time in exile against the background of this, and it's really bouncing off it, really. And without that, you don't and can't read it. Continuing, Yahweh alone, not Marduk, controls the heavens. Chapter 40 and 45. Yahweh, not Marduk, reigns as king. Chapter 52. The Babylonians shout, none among the gods can equal Marduk. Again and again, the prophet scribes or the prophet preachers proclaim that nothing can compare to Yahweh. I am Yahweh. There is no other. The hopes of the exiles were realized, to jump ahead, when Cyrus entered Babylon in triumph in 539 BC. However, Cyrus is going to be called in our texts the Messiah, extraordinary thing, the one sent by God. Well, just as the Assyrians were sent by God to punish, we saw that, didn't we? Just as the Babylonians were sent by God, because God controls everything that's happening, to punish, so Cyrus is sent by God to redeem. And so he's actually called the Messiah, the Messiah, the one they've been looking for to bring about their redemption. He didn't, however, live up to their expectations. In any case, he was killed in battle in 530 while they were still in exile. The preaching of the prophet preachers, however, fell, for the most part, on deaf ears. Which doesn't happen today. Preaching, everyone jumps to their feet and says, Alleluia, whenever anything's said from every pulpit in the diocese. But in those days, it fell on deaf ears. And for the most of my, and we notice, we won't notice it today, but you'll certainly notice it next week. And if you look ahead or read ahead in the commentary, you'll see it. There's a shift in direction once you get to chapter 49 to 55. And that's why I've separated it out for next week. The prophet preaches, experiencing indifference and rejection. Most of the Jews in exile didn't go back. Most of them were happy where they were, and the thought of going back to that God-forsaken place they'd left, which has now been destroyed, the temple and the Jerusalem, and they were doing well here. They'd started up Rothschild's bank. They had the Mediterranean. You know, Jews are good at this. I'm speaking a little bit out of context, a bit anachronistically, but they'd settled in and were doing quite well, thank you. And they didn't want all this palaver about going back. In other words, they probably became atheistic or equivalent, gave up their faith. So the prophet preachers, experiencing indifference and rejection, realize that it's up to them, their group, to keep the prophetic word alive because the community aren't listening. It's these servants of Yahweh and their followers who back in Judah, after the exile, compose the chapters 56 to 66, which we'll do in two, three weeks' time. They continue to update the sayings of Isaiah in Isaiah 2 to 39. They include the exilic reflections of chapter 40 to 55, which is our topic today and next week. And then they preface the book with chapter 1, hence the Isaiah scroll. Now, I've done a lot of that with you already. I'll have to take that as read. These three blocks of material combine to produce our scroll. So a map, and then we begin the text. There's a map. Jerusalem, you can see over there near the Mediterranean. Yeah. And Babylon is here on the Euphrates River. That's the Tigris there. That's the Arabian Desert. The Fertile Crescent goes like that. So they had to go up and then down to Babylon. And that's how far they are away. To return home, however they go home, it's easy for them to imagine coming from Egypt, you know, Moses. They're reliving Moses' experience crossing the desert, because the desert's facing them to the west, and they have to go once again, trek through there, led by God.